You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
So, ladies and gentlemen, Commissioner Hahn has made it. We actually, when I went outside after making the announcement, saw him running up the street. So poor Commissioner Hahn is now a little bit out of breath, trying to get here on time. As I said earlier, we'll dispense with the introductions. We'll give him a little moment to catch his breath and have a glass of water. As you all know, Commissioner Hahn is really in the thick of things right now on the European front. There's a lot of issues to talk about. He's going to give us a brief overview of some of the issues that he is contending with presently. And then, as I said, we'll go straight to Q&A with you in the audience as soon as we've heard. So thank you again for joining us. And Commissioner Hahn, thank you for running to get here. We really appreciate it on such a very busy and a day with so many difficult issues to contend with. The podium's yours. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And first of all, excuse for being late. But on the other hand, I can promise you that today nobody is beaten up or pushed around at Brookings, because, as you know, Europe is a soft power. This is maybe the difference. Maybe also the reason why I'm late. I have no bodyguards and nobody who is pushing me through the traffic. But I think this is the better way. You stay healthy.
We agree.
One of my key challenges as Commissioner for European Neighbourhood Policy and Enlargement Negotiation is, of course, deepening the relationship with our neighbours. Neighbourhood policy and enlargement are tools for that. Geopolitical rationale is obvious. If Europe doesn't export and guarantee stability, we will import instability. And that's why, of course, our main objective is to have stability in our neighbourhood. Pulling up drawbridges is not the answer, and common European foreign policy is therefore not a luxury, but a necessity. The migration crisis just shows it, and maybe we'll come on this later. I think the European Union has achieved a lot in the past decade, so we should not be masochistic on this, and enlargement firmly stays on the agenda, but is conditional to reforms. We have learned our lessons from previous accession rounds that it is necessary to have a process with our candidate countries in order to allow them to be at a level which is acceptable by our citizens, and therefore it's more about the process and less about negotiations, which we have to do. And therefore, there is a focus on the economic development. And of course, I'm deeply convinced that economic development is also pushing fundamental development, the development on fundamentals. There is a relationship between both. You can only attract foreign investors, but even people inside the country will only risk their own money to establish a company, for instance, if they can rely on an independent judiciary, on transparency, low level of corruption, ideally no corruption. But this is something one has to address. And that's why the economic, focus is so decisive for us. But when we are talking about neighbourhood policy, it's more than in the past that we are looking into our own interests. What are the European interests? And of course, the main European interest, if you're looking around, is to have stability. I think it was said, and somebody was quoting this famous song of Johnny Cash, this ring of friends has evolved into a ring of fire, and we are there to extinguish it and to create stability, prosperity, welfare in our neighborhood. I think this is for us the best guarantee to to have stability. And therefore the question is, how to invest in stability? And it's so important to stress this term in investment, because it's also important for us to understand much better. We have to invest. We have to take some money, but also other, so to say, resources. It's about our own energy, our own commitment to deal with our neighbors, to be engaged, to understand more, so to say, also their interests, their concerns, their troubles and their problems, but also their interests and their challenges. And that's why it is so important to have this clear understanding and perception. We have to invest, because if you invest, you expect to get something in return. And if I'm saying to get something in return, it's not only about money, it's about, for instance, peace, stability, prosperity, satisfaction for citizens. And this is probably more important and important for us than to get money back. Okay, we would like to get money back, which we have invested, but the idea of this kind of investment is indeed to have this stability. We are looking into it. And once again, if you're looking in our neighborhood and if you compare it to the situation 10 years ago, the situation is certainly less stable than it was 10 years ago. There are terrible conflicts, violence in many of the Arab transition countries. We have transnational terrorism. We are confronted with a Russian foreign policy which doesn't respect the sovereignty of neighbors. And last but not least, we have a refugee and migration crisis. And therefore, of course, one could arrive at this description that we are now surrounded by a ring of fire. So in 2015, I took a hard look at the way we work and asked, what can we do better and how? And once again, our central objective is stabilization. We have to become smarter at promoting stabilization both in the East and the South. If not, instability will continue to proliferate. But stabilization doesn't mean propping up autocratic or corrupt regimes. Not old realpolitik, but more realistic politics, more pragmatism is needed. Neighbors face incredible, complex modernization challenges, especially in the rule of law and economic development. Of course, we have to accept that this will not happen overnight. It requires, also in that respect, a kind of patient investment. And by the way, this is something we have also to admit, that some of our member states still need some internal, may I say, developments. Therefore, it's so crucial to push the fundamentals, but also, as I have said, the economic development. Without them, partners won't flourish. So stabilization means working for long-term political, economic, and social transformation, but in a more robust, hands-on, and may I say, less naive way. See, for instance, the refugee and the migration crisis. Without addressing the root causes, instability, lack of perspectives and conflicts, we won't get very far. At the same time, we have to defend our short-term interests and literally draw the border. I think it's so important for us, the Europeans, to invest in an effective border control at land, but also at sea. Without an effective border control, we are nowhere. And this is something we have to have in focus. And I hope that our member states and also the European Parliament will come very soon to a decision tabled by the European Commission already last year. So what we have to do about this, I mean not only the border control, but in order to create this stability in our neighborhood. First, we have to understand there is no one-size-fits-all solution. We have to accept that greater differentiation is needed. Our partners are very diverse. not just between the East and the South, but if you take, for instance, the East within the East, and the same applies for the South. That means designing and tailoring solutions for us, the European Union, but also for each partner to get more leverage and finally to have a better traction. Second, while retaining these ambitions, we need a focus on a specific number of priorities, also this as a result of a necessary tailor-made approach. And finally, if you take the economic aspect, it's not only about this, there's also a very strong element, a very strong component, and this is security. In particular, focus on preventing radicalization, which leads very often to violence. We're also working on the security sector reform, counterterrorism, and border management. It's something where in the past, the Union, in particular my policy area, was never involved. We didn't provide money for that, but we have changed our opinion, taking into account the very recent developments and how things are interlinked to each other. So our aim is definitely to increase our own flexibility, also our own flexibility in terms to apply different solutions, different programs, I have also to admit that our neighbors never stop to surprise us, and therefore we have to be flexible to respond in an adequate mean and to develop always new tools if necessary. And for instance, the trust funds is such a good example where 2 years ago we started to anticipate what might come up and have introduced these new instruments, which allows us to react much more quicker than it was the case in the past to very recent developments in the region. I mean, it's not a particular secret. The European Union and its institutions are sometimes a little bit cumbersome. I'm always saying we are too cumbersome to think. Yeah, and this is also something you can rely on. That's why, nevertheless, sometimes it's necessary to be a little bit more speedy, more flexible, and for that purpose we have created this trust fund so you can trust us. It goes into the right direction. And therefore, finally, ownership is also so important, so crucial. It's about a real partnership with our neighbors. It's not that we would like to impose something and quasi take it or leave it, but it's about creating a mutual tiny network of trust and confidence between us and our neighbors, and identify really the area where we can and where we should cooperate. And finally, I believe in most of the cases, or I would say always, we share the same interest. Also, our partners would like to have stability, prosperity, perspective for their people. In many of these countries, they are facing a brain drain, often a brain drain towards Europe, and this is something we also have to address, because for us, if we would like to have stability in our neighborhood, we have to have an interest to turn this brain drain in a brain circulation in order to give people a perspective to move back, to work on the further development of their country, to use their experience gained, for instance, in Europe when working or studying. But it's also important to have this perspective, this task in mind. And therefore, tailor-made solutions are so important. I give you a few examples. With Jordan and Lebanon, also as an outcome of this refugee crisis, we have developed and designed specifically what we call a compact agreement with the country, a comprehensive one, which not only includes financial engagement, but also to look into some regulatory measures which might be supportive to further develop these countries. Or if I give you a very concrete example, as a result of many trips and missions to these countries, to these regions, they are facing, by the way, a similar problem like we have in Europe and maybe also here in the States. It's a lack of skilled labor workforce. So we have to invest, for instance, in vocational training, that the interests of the business sector are matched with the education and the qualification schemes. And in that respect, I think we should invest much more. And this is another contribution to the further development on this, in these countries. Or if you take Tunisia, I was there only last week. I think they have taken very courageous decisions, and we have to support them, we have to help them. It's quasi the European hub in the region. They are committed to democracy. They are really committed to harmonize, so to say, their social and historic background with the Enlightenment. And I think this is something we have to support, we have to to support. And really, Tunisia could serve as a kind of gateway to Africa for us, the Europeans. If you take Libya, and by the way, here Tunisia played a very important role, facilitating finally, together with many others, hopefully now a government which might be still fragile, but for the first time there is something and we can build on it, and hopefully it will stabilize not only the country, but therefore the whole region. If you look in the eastern neighborhood, there is already a very good basis for cooperation with Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia with this association agreement. Probably there might be some questions later on about our assessment in, about the situation in Ukraine, the impact of the Dutch referendum situation in Moldova. But let's be clear. In general, I think we are, with all up and downs, on a good way, on a good path. It's not easy, but if we are pushy enough, if we are clear enough, what has to be done, but if we are also, so to say, intelligent enough to understand what is achievable and what is not achievable, also in terms of the timeline and the time perspective, I think we can achieve a lot, and this is also in the interest of these people. And I mean, Ukraine is certainly a particular challenge, and I don't want to elaborate too lengthy on it. May I say, there is a new government in place. There are many being concerned that it might be less reform-oriented than the previous one. If you look, so to say, into the names, it might be the case. But on the other hand, may I say, this government, although there is only a tiny majority in the Rada, nevertheless, I believe, if they are willing to take political decisions, they are probably stronger than the previous government. And it's now the task, the obligation, and the duty of the international community to push them into the right direction. And if we coordinate our efforts, and this is one of the reasons why I am, as a non-financial, so to say, experts participating in the spring meeting, to use the contacts to our international financial institutions and partners to coordinate our efforts in different countries in our neighborhood. And Ukraine is such an example. Moldova is another one. And as I have it here in my briefing, Belarus might be the same. And so I could tell you examples from different countries, Armenia, Azerbaijan, other ones, where we are following this very tailor-made approach and solution to identify ways and means how we can cooperate without overstretching the possibilities and room of maneuver of those countries. But I think it's also here our interest, their interest. And may I say, it should also be the interest of the neighbor, of our neighbors, and this is in particular Russia, to work together to share the common economic interests. And if we are all together able to develop the economic potential of this region with millions of people, this would give us all a lot of opportunities and could contribute and can contribute and will contribute to the stabilization of the region. So let me say some final words on the migration challenge, which is for the moment, of course, one of the most pressing issues in Europe, and probably it might stay. because one has to differentiate between refugees and migrants. This is very often mixed up. I think we have found, also heavily criticized, with Turkey, I wouldn't say a solution, but an agreement which finally led to a significant decline of refugees / migrants to Europe via the Western Balkan route. I'm stressing this term migrants because only last summer, 80% of the people arriving in Greece have been Syrians. Around New Year, in early spring, I would say this share was 20 to 30%. The rest, or the huge majority, have been people from other parts which in the windfall of this wave wanted to come or want to come to Europe for very understandable economic reasons. So we have to find ways to regain control about our external borders. We are not blocking them, but we have to be clear who can come in and who cannot come in. And in that respect, I think it was necessary to have this cooperation with Turkey. But I have also to stress that the action plan comprises not only areas related to the refugee crisis, but is also about stimulating our mutual cooperation. Turkey is, for us, the Europeans, a key strategic partner. And I would say for Turkey, if there is a rational assessment, Europe is the most important partner because we are reliable, we are accountable, and if they are looking into the geostrategic situation, they should have a strong interest to have a partner which is, once again, accountable, and also a partner which is the most important one in economic and trade terms. That's why part of this action plan is also to push for an upgrading of our custom union, to speed up, if you like, the accession negotiations, but also visa liberalization is another issue which is important for stimulating the economic mutual development. But may I say, my bigger concern in terms of migrants, maybe less refugees, is the Western Mediterranean. That's, once again, it is so important to have a government in Libya in place in order to have at least an interlocutor for the future. If you like, I would like to stop at this point. Once again, I think it's important, and I would like to stress this because maybe it wasn't so explicit said and in particular applied in the past, but we are really following our own interests in relationship to our neighborhood. In that respect, may I say, the United States might serve as a good example how to be successful, and this is also important for us. If we have stability in our neighborhood, we can go the next step. We believe as Europeans, the European way of life, democracy, so to say, supporting the individual is the most successful concept. Otherwise, it would not be possible if only 7% of world population are by far still the biggest economic bloc in the world. We are contributing 22-23% to the global turnout, and this is still a remarkable figure. I don't say we have to defend it. This is unrealistic, but it still indicates how strong we are. And maybe we should tell this, and that's why I'm here, that we might be a soft power, but behind the soft power there's a lot of determination. And may I say, this saying, united in diversity, is not a signal of weakness, it's a signal of strength. Thank you very much.
Commissioner Hahn, thank you very much. I'll turn over to the audience in just 1 second after you've got your microphone attached here. I'll take three questions or so at a time and then get back to you. I have a microphone here. I mean, one thing just to conclude with where you ended, that paradoxically the refugee and migrant crisis is also a sign of success of Europeans' power. You know, there are a lot of places that... you know, don't attract migrants, and Europe has actually been overwhelmed by the success of its model. And I think that, you know, this is obviously something that we should bear in mind here. One other question before pulling the audiences in two is some of the other crises ahead, and perhaps as we bring in the other questions, you could reflect on that. I hesitate to say it, but from my own accent, it will be obvious that you might end up with one more neighbour, hopefully not, after June 23rd, which could add to some interesting elements on this. You might not want to really comment on that. I mean, some of these issues are a little tricky at this prospective moment, but I think you're certainly in an expanding area of the European Commission. So, you know, we have a lot of things that I'm sure that people will want to ask you about. So, who's
got the mic? May I say, I am already busy enough with my existing neighbours.
Yes, you prefer that they didn't do that, right?
Yeah. I'm happy to leave it as it is.
Yes, I think that's kind of the message a lot of people are certainly saying. So, we'll move here, sir. And if you could just, first of all, say who you are, and then a question, please, for the Commission, and then we'll take two others.
Meto Koloski with the United Macedonian Diaspora, and today there's massive protests in Macedonia, given the current situation with the president pardoning about 56 cases of gross misconduct, particularly in electoral fraud. And so what are you planning on doing? I know you've had a statement in regards to the president's decision, but what are the next steps? What role do you see yourself in? And are there going to be other EU officials getting involved?
Thanks very much. And just behind you, the lady.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm Carl Venmark, a visiting Nordic fellow at CSIS. I was wondering if we could talk about the Eastern Partnership for a moment. There's certainly a sense in this town that or some people might say that the Riga summit lacked ambition. I wouldn't agree with that, and I would say that the arguments and the efforts for political and financial integration is still very much there. But I would welcome some thoughts from you, perhaps, where you see this process going and if there's any momentum there. Certainly with the landscape in Europe right now, expansion might be a tricky issue. At the same time, the arguments, as you mentioned, are very much there in place. So where do you see the Eastern Partnership going, and what can we expect within the next, perhaps, 2-3 years with respect to Georgia and perhaps also Ukraine? Thank you very much.
Can you get the microphone to the lady behind you? Yeah, thank you.
Hi, my name is Irene Benedicto. I'm with FNews. And also as a European, I wanted to know if you will consider this recent agreement between the EU and Turkey, in behalf of which deportations are reportedly increasing, as part of these smarter policies that you were talking about. And if that is the case, how will that help to solve the migrants and refugees crisis? Thank you.
Thank you. So that's three quite diverse questions.
Well, on Fyrom, I'm really disappointed about the very recent developments. We have invested a lot in having this June-July agreement from last year to bring the country back on a Euro-Atlantic path. And I mean, also most of the deadlines haven't been met when they should have been met. Finally, it was done. And that's why the fact that now the elections at the 5th of June are under difficult situations, and finally, and honestly, I don't know how it will look like after the elections. I think I can only urge all the parties and also the civil society, but in particular the political parties, to come back to the negotiation table and to stay committed on the Euro-Atlantic perspective of the country. If they are not working together, if they are not, so to say, focused to have fair elections, the country will not, and the new government will not be, so to say, internationally accepted, not to say recognized. And this is what is decisive and where all of them should understand what is at stake. And I hope we can pass this message. Members of the European Parliament and myself will try another effort to bring them together, to facilitate something. I can nothing promise, but it's also part of something where I hope that gradually people in the region and in some other parts understand that democracy means to strike a deal, a compromise, and not to have this winner or loser attitude. Otherwise, you will never be successful. And the people in the region deserve a better future, and a better future is only achievable if there's a clear European perspective. And this includes a European or a democratic understanding of rule of law. And I think this is already an answer to the pardoning, comprehensive pardoning of people by the president of the state. About the Eastern Partnership, I think you have rightly mentioned Riga. We have these biannual summits. Honestly, I believe we have to change a little bit this character, that it becomes more a kind of stock-taking event. Mm-hmm. Because if you have always a summit, there are always expectations. Mm-hmm. And I doubt if we can always deliver on something new. I mean, in the past, we have announced and delivered where they wanted to have it on a TCFDA, on an association agreement, visa liberalization. So it's now really to implement what has been achieved. This is certainly less glorious. It's hard working, and therefore my preference would be to have biannual stock-taking meetings where we can see what has been achieved. And once again, for the different countries, we have different solutions, also based on their own opportunities. But in general, may I say, the common brackets are definitely to support the economic and societal development of these countries and to create welfare, peace and stability, which is of our interest and I would say also in the interest of the neighbor. On Turkey, honestly, I didn't quite understand the question.
It was the issue of deportations. Returning people from the European Union to Turkey, and then whether this is really going to help the situation. As I understood, is that correct?
Look, the intention of this agreement or of this solution was to try out this human trafficking and smuggling. And once again, to say we would like to check who is arriving and coming to Europe. We haven't abandoned the opportunity to seek asylum. This was never the issue, but we have to check who can really get asylum and who might be a migrant. But the whole agreement is, so to say, from our side, also respecting all the international laws and agreements. And this was the reason why this return procedure was quasi delayed. It was not delayed because we had to prepare the legal ground in order to guarantee a correct procedure respecting international agreements and international law.
Let's see, I'll take a question right at the back. Someone had their arm up before. Yes, that's right. Thank you. And then I'll come back down again.
Thank you. Leandra Bernstein, Sputnik International News. A question on the Dutch referendum on Ukraine, whether that's going to impact the association agreements going forward, and also whether, in your view, you're concerned that Ukraine and other partners could view this referendum as the EU giving partnership with one hand and then taking away with the other.
Thank you. There was a gentleman over here on the left. Yeah, oh, Steve, yeah, hold on, wait for Mike.
Hello, Stephen Wallace. I would like to ask you about the situation with the refugees where the Austrian government felt compelled to organize a regional solution involving most of the countries in Central Europe. And even though this was welcomed by, the president of the council, Donald Tusk, it drew a lot of criticism from Berlin, from Merkel. Basically, do you feel that this kind of regional solution fits in with a larger EU policy, or do you view it as a challenge to reaching kind of European solutions within a larger EU framework?
Thanks. And there was one other here, and then I'll come back to another round again.
George Angiopriza, Commissioner, thank you for your speech. One of the points you mentioned was that the approach you use with respect to promoting stability is to convince Russia of the benefits, of the common benefits that come with promoting greater stability, particularly long-term economic benefits. How effective do you think that strategy has been? And do you employ or do you intend to employ other methods as well to promote greater stability?
Thank you, Commissioner.
Well, on the Dutch referendum, the outcome has to be respected. There was a self-commitment by the Dutch government, if there's a certain turnout, to respect this. But one has to say 27 member states have already ratified this association agreement. So for the moment, it's provisionally in force. It only, in inverted commas, affects the association agreement, not the DCFTA. So this deep and comprehensive trade agreement is not affected by this referendum. But the ball is now in the camp of the Dutch government. They have to come forward with an idea. I think they are reflecting on it. Once again, we have to respect this this popular vote. And we will see what are the next steps. But for the time being, there is, so to say, no reason to change anything in relation with Ukraine. And, that's what I can say for the moment. On this behavior of Austria and some other countries in Europe, one has to say the refugee crisis is one of these examples where there is a particular issue which affects some countries, and many other countries of the European Union are less affected. And therefore, the general, so to say, interest to find a solution is less intensive than it would be the case if all are more or less equally affected, as it was, for instance, the case just previously on the economic, due to the economic and financial crisis. And this was the reason why some countries took certain measures in order to push, and I would say one should see it under this kind of spotlight, to push for a European solution. So at a certain moment, it was a measure being applied by one or two countries, but finally leading to a quicker decision on the European level. At the end, only a European solution is a sustainable one. That's why, once again, I stress the need of a common European border protection mechanism. That's the only way out. On Georgia, as an example, once again, what I would like to pass as a message also in the way we are acting is Europe is not an aggressive partner. We are not trying to extend our territories. What we would like to see is stability, peace, prosperity in our neighborhood, giving people in the countries the right, the possibility to decide on their own, and demonstrate that a peaceful development is achievable. And for that, once again, we have to see the individual possibilities of each of our neighbors. I think the way we are dealing currently with Georgia is one of these good examples. And I hope people can see very soon the added value of this kind of cooperation. We have this DCFTA since, I would say, now 1.5 years in force. There have been already some first signs that this pays off. The export to Europe has increased. And these are opportunities which are, so to say, transferred into jobs in the country. And this is another element how to stabilize and to develop a country and a society.
Thanks very much. I have a question here at the front and then behind as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Does it work? Yeah.
Matteo
Garavaglia, Brookings. We have the 15 billion plus euros of the ENI. The EDF, which I know is not really you, and you have to be careful what you say because Mimica might not take it too well, but it's 30 billion plus. Now they are happily aligned in terms of time frame. They go 2014 to 2020, both of them. Two questions in that respect connected to one another. First of all, how do you see the way we'll use the ENI up to 2020? Will you see that that money is being used as with a rain approach or very few carrots, but very, very big carrots, so being very concentrated? And second one, which is a bit more speculative in that respect, do you think that what we're seeing there is effectively the conditions coming into place for an attempt in the coming years to budgetize the EDF and somehow aligning more closely with the work you're doing through the ENI? Thank you.
Thanks. Gentlemen here and then here.
Yeah. Thank you.
So, yeah.
Maurice Urbain. And I had a question about the what role, if any, you thought the United States and NATO would play in the enforcement of border security in and around the European Union. Thank you.
Thank you. And then a question here at the front.
Thank you. David Riley from the British Embassy here in Washington. Actually, my question follows that one very neatly. You set out very well, Commissioner, the large number of challenges we face now, which, in the view of my government, require a comprehensive and sort of full-spectrum response. And EU-NATO cooperation, I think, feels as more important than ever. I mean, my government feels we've fallen short of what we need to achieve. So in your mind, what would a successful Warsaw Summit look like in terms of securing deliverables on EU-NATO cooperation?
So the Warsaw Summit in NATO,
and
whether that will help with EU-NATO cooperation. And the other question was about the US role in border security as well. I suppose quite a few people in the US are wondering whether visa introduction may also come in. Did somebody else have a related question? I saw somebody waving their hand back there at one point as well. Did anybody else have a question that follows on from any of these? No, okay. Commissioner, we'll go back to you. Thank you.
Well, starting with the EDF, honestly, I don't want to comment on it, but in general, I would always prefer to have it there inside the budget. But this is something which is subject to discussions with our member states. On ENI, the way how we spend the money, I think indeed here we are, or I am trying to change a little bit the way to do this. First, that's why also in my introduction I have already stressed this character or this this notion investment, because I like to move from being a donor or a spender to an investor. but it's more about this so to say, principles I have elaborated. That I mean, if you give somebody a money, if you give a grant, maybe people are less analyzing and assessing if the quality of a project is really a good one. If you give a loan, which you have to repay, the quality of the assessment and the project is certainly a better one. And if we apply even more financial instruments, we can leverage our financial opportunities. Number one. Number two, if we have less projects, we create definitely more visibility, and we can also focus on certain areas. For instance, yesterday we had, I think, a very good discussion with our financial partners, World Bank, Monetary Fund, EBRD, EIB, on energy efficiency in our neighborhood, that we have a joint effort to address this issue. Why I'm saying this? People could say, okay, this is something addressing climate action and so on, but to have more energy efficiency has a huge political impact, which again has an impact on the stability in the region. Why? I give you two figures. In the south, we have an increase of 6 to 8% annually in terms of the energy consumption or electricity consumption. So in 10 years' time, the consumption is doubled. That means that in many countries, the dependency on energy and energy supply is increasing. So our interest must be to work on a further diversification of energy sources, but also of energy supplier. But an important element is to slow down the increase of energy or electricity consumption. And that's why energy efficiency is so important. And by the way, if we are looking into the isolation of buildings in the south, but also in the east, you can gain a lot, or you can lose a lot. And if you address this, you automatically boost the local economy, because thermal isolation is extremely labor-intensive and is giving job opportunities for small and medium-sized enterprises. So it's, in many dimensions, a win-win situation. Or if I take the East, Ukraine, in Ukraine, they waste 11 times more gas than the European average. If they would be at the level of the European average, they wouldn't need to import any cubic meter of gas. Imagine what this would mean in political terms for the country if they are not forced to import any gas. And this is why you see this link between certain areas, measures, and the impact on the policy, and further on the kind of stability we would like to achieve. On US NATO, honestly, it should be the task of the Europeans to take care about their own border protection. And this is honestly my aim to achieve this. And I will do everything what I can do. But I appreciate, for instance, the flexibility and the quick response when it came to deploy a NATO, operation in the Aegean Sea to monitor the whole situation, because this is what NATO is doing, to monitor and to observe, but certainly to support certain measures on the Turkish, but also on the Greek side. I think this is a good example, but it's also a kind of exemption, as it affects two NATO member countries, which is not the case everywhere around Europe. Once again, my aim is simply to have a peaceful development of our neighborhood. And may I say, the fact, you have said it, Fiona, at the beginning, we are a soft power, but apparently a very attractive one. Mm-hmm. So the softness is still attractive, but I have no problems to say, finally, we have to complement this softness by some hard facts. Mm-hmm. And that's why I believe by the end of the day we need a real common European foreign and security policy.
This issue that you've just raised at the end there, and there was the reference to the Warsaw Summit, I know there'll probably be a couple of questions about that, but that does... Your comments do come against the backdrop of the reports that were all over the U.S. Press today of Russian aircraft buzzing a U.S. Ship in the Baltic and carrying a Polish helicopter, and you know the exercising of hard force right there in Europe's maritime waters. That brings other dimensions in. I know that's not exactly in your purview, but it does make it much more complicated in the context of trying to secure Europe's borders. And I wonder if you might have some thoughts on this, and I'll also bring in others from the audience. I also, because we were in a little hurry at the beginning, neglected to thank one of our key partners in actually making this event possible, the Heinrich Böll Stiftung, the German Green Foundation. I see my colleague... Bastian Hermissian sitting here, and I hope he was pleased with the response about climate and and energy issues. But you probably know that there was quite a very important interview that President Obama gave to an American journalist, Jeffrey Goldberg, in The Atlantic, a magazine here that's created quite a stir in foreign policy circles, not least in this think tank here. And President Obama, in the interview, he didn't downplay the threat of extremism and extremist violence, but he did say that the big existential threat, in his view, remains climate change. And as you've touched upon this in the energy response, given the refugee and migration crisis, I think we can only anticipate that this is going to be more of an issue in the future. Have you started to think in the engagement with the neighbours about how one might mitigate some of the climate change issues in some of the investments that you've been talking about? You did touch upon that energy efficiency in some way. But there's been any active thinking in that basket of the European Union's activity on how you might actually start to work with some of the neighbours now? I mean, certainly increased desertification in some of the neighbouring regions. We've got long-term drought in some of... Europe's immediate neighbourhood, within European countries as well, a great deal of concern, obviously, about climate change and rising seawaters, about how that might be factoring into some of your policies now. And then there was a question here from our colleague, visiting fellow here from the European Union, and then I'll take one more question from this gentleman at the back and allow you to wrap up as well. So, Alaa.
Thanks. My name's Alaa Olium. My day job is with the External Action Service in Brussels, but I'm here as a visiting fellow. My question is regarding what you just mentioned at the end there regarding a stronger CFSP, and also one of the terms that came into currency during the review of the neighborhood policy, that is the neighbors of the neighbors. And I think you'll agree that the realization was that Europe could not effectively implement its goals in the neighborhood policy without taking into consideration the neighbors of the neighbors. With Ukraine, obviously Russia is the key. How do you see things going forward now with the sanctions and with the implementation of Minsk? Because obviously without that, it's very difficult to achieve the objectives that you've set out for Ukraine. On the south, I'd like to ask about Turkey. This is not a neighborhood issue, but the enlargement. Part of the deal with Turkey was that the enlargement process would be revitalized. And we see possibly a Cyprus resolution removing that obstacle also. How do you see this playing out during your term? And lastly, one that has not come up here, but I think certainly in my period in Brussels, working on the southern neighborhood, Egypt was a huge disappointment. Initially, in the beginning of the Arab Spring, it looked like it was going to be engaging with Europe in all fronts. And now it's very much one of those transactional, so-called transactional countries. With regard to the neighbors of the neighbors, one of the reasons I think Egypt really strayed was that some of the Gulf countries came in with money and with influence and really steered Egypt away from engagement with Europe. Do you see that changing at all also during your term? Thank you.
Thanks. And then one last question to the gentleman here on the left. Thank you.
Vyacheslav Petrushkin from the Embassy of Moldova. Commissioner, could you please comment on the current stage of the implementation of the project related to building the gas interconnectors between among EU member states and between EU and countries from Eastern Partnership? Thank you.
Thank you. I think we've given you a lot to finish on there, and I don't want you to have to run to your next meeting. So thank you for your patience with all those questions.
Next meeting is a pledging conference.
Oh, is it?
So it's cheaper to stay here.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, we can detain you if you need it. I think that could be arranged.
But it's also contributing to stability in the region.
Right, so right. Yes, I guess you have to go, right?
We should go. May I start with the last one on Moldova and the gas interconnect? This is another element, so to say, to create stability in our neighborhood, to diversify once again sources, but in particular suppliers, and to create more independence for our partners. In the current this current project is that I think there is an interconnect already at the border between Romania and Moldova installed or built. I'm not a technician. But what is missing is the last stretch between the border and Chisinau, but certainly it will come, and it's one of our, so to say, most emblematic projects in the region. On this whole issue of climate change, I'm grateful if President Obama at the end of his term in office recognizes this huge importance. I think the Europeans have always spearheaded this issue worldwide, and may I say, for instance, my colleague Canette was traveling for more than 1 year around the world to prepare very thoroughly the Paris summit, and this time apparently it was seen as a successful summit. Mm-hmm. But more has to be done. I can only tell you, in my previous mandate as Commissioner for Regional Policy for the Structural Funds in Europe, I started to introduce, or I pushed, and finally it worked out, to have a legal provision in our own regulations that for energy efficiency measures and renewable energy production, our member states, and in particular those who are getting a lot of money from the European Union, has to use a minimum percentage of the overall allocation for energy efficiency and renewable energy production measures. Mm-hmm. And it was on average 20% of the money, and finally it turned out that I think 38% of the money was programmed by our member states exactly for this purpose. And may I say, this has served as a role model for myself. Mm-hmm. To apply something similar, or to look in something similar in my new dossier. An example, Western Balkan, they have a huge potential on hydropower, which is not yet really exploited. Albania is the only one who has done a lot. But some other countries like Serbia, probably Montenegro, could use more of them. And this is why within the so-called Berlin process, it's an interregional cooperation between the six Western Balkan countries, the next step will be to work on a hydropower master plan for the region. which is not only about renewable energy production, but it means also to have a common energy market, common tariffs, working on a, so to say, a reliable grid system, having contractual arrangements between the countries. The one are producing renewable energy, the others, like Kosovo, they have a strong fossil energy production plant, I think based on coal. Mm-hmm. And for the peaks, you need this traditional way of energy production. And if you have this in place, it's another element of cooperation, reconciliation in the region, which is definitely helpful, mm-hmm. also in political terms. So I think this is something. And may I say, I am extremely grateful that in September there will be a big migration conference, I think, in New York, on a global scale. It will be certainly the biggest challenge for the whole world in the 21st century, in particular because of the climate change and all the effects related to it. On the neighbors of our neighbors, I think it's important to stress that we are not only, so to say, referring or reaching out to Russia, but also to the Arab world. And I used the opportunity of this weekend to see a lot of partners from the Arab world, financial institutions, to explore how we can cooperate in this region, because probably we share finally the same interests as I have explained previously. It's about stability, and I think we need a pragmatic approach. And if there's one stability, and which when we have anchored, so to say, this, we can go the next step. And the next step, it's probably not during my mandate, but so to say, I would like to see, so to say, a kind of heritage that others can build on, in a way that they can go the next step with our partners in the region to improve living conditions of people. We are starting, or we have already done, and we will do it further on, to support civil society initiatives in all our neighboring countries. But one has to be realistic that you can't change mentalities, cultural experiences within a couple of months or within a season. It takes some time, but one has to be committed.
Well, that's actually a great word to finish on. One has to be committed. And thank you very much for being committed to getting over here as well. We really do appreciate that. We know how difficult it was for you today with all of the other events that you had to attend. I think this has been a very rich set of questions, and we wish you all the very best of luck with your next meetings and with the very challenging mandate that you have. Thank you so much, Commissioner Hahn. Thank you.